Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we absolutely love about being on two wheels. Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, saving you money on your annual bike, scooter and moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Now, today's guest, let me just tell you, is one of Britain's, in fact, probably one of the world's most popular stand-up comedians. He's an acclaimed actor of stage and screen. If it's to do with engines, he will be in love with it. Petrol runs through his veins. He's forever on our TV screens, although he lives in Australia where he's talking to us from today. Good day, Ross Noble. Hello, mate.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good, good. Thanks for joining us, mate. I mean it on that intro, literally.
Pleasure.
Anything to do with petrol, I also mean the bit about you being so well loved and you're a legend, but anything to do with petrol, we have lots of guests on here who love motorbikes, but for you, it's everything, isn't it? Tanks, cars,
yeah.
Anything with an engine, you will love it.
Well, you know what? It's funny you should say that, because it's one of those things where I wouldn't class myself as a, you know how you get your sort of, like I love Clarkson and all of those, you know, all of those guys, I'm not one of these people that sort of I like a petrol head. I'm not one of these people that will kind of that's just into the machines themselves. I like driving stuff and operating things, and you know, I used to have a tank and I had earth moving equipment and stuff. I just like driving and riding and playing with stuff, rather than being one of these people that goes, "Ah, well, in the 73 model, there was a Wankel engine on there." I'm not into all of that, you know. But yeah, I just love driving and riding stuff. Yeah,
I love the simplicity of that, Ross. And we said at the top, and obviously we're chatting to you from the other side of the world, and it's somewhere that you've called home for a long time now, but the accent does betray the fact that you're from the north of England, like myself, and it's a part of the world that is so idiosyncratic and unique. Does that mean you miss it a lot?
Well, we're living in Australia now, but we're to be honest, we keep moving all the time. So yeah. I think we're moving back. So yeah, because weirdly, actually, over here, I mean, there are some like incredible places to go riding, but there's. I do kind of miss, the one thing that I do miss is the sort of, what you don't get here is the guys in, is the old blokes with flat caps and thermoses, you know, that sort of, you know, if you go and do, because I love trials riding, and there's a real sort of shed, I quite like that sort of shed culture, you know.
Yeah.
Old blokes going, aye, very good, son, very good, aye. Like all that, so yeah.
But you're doing all right out there. As I said earlier, if you're ever on the screens in the UK, I know you're always on the screens in Australia as well. You're touring with Cranium of Curiosities, and I know you're bringing that to the UK. First and foremost, what is that tour all about? What can we expect? And most importantly, I know you're coming to Winchester, so I need some tickets in November. I'm coming to see you.
Right, consider it done. Two tickets, Winchester sorted. I'll make sure I write that down. I'm going to be, from October onwards, right through until next year. Look, it's become very fashionable now for certain comedians to be doing shows where it's got a theme. Some would say it's got a point. God forbid a message. You'll get none of that with me. You won't learn anything. There's no through line. You're not really sure. Sometimes you might walk away not entirely sure what you've witnessed.
What you just said.
I've got to say, Prutz, I went to see Ross a few years ago in Southampton, and I walked away just thinking, what was all that about? I loved it. The time just flew by, but you're very reactive to the crowd. What I mean by that is you're very reactive. I know obviously you've got an idea where you're going to go with it, but it felt to me like you just went, oh, forget that, I'm going off this way because someone said this in the audience. And you're very, obviously, very sharp and witty, but it's very clever. Your act that I saw, it's very clever.
I get easily distracted. And that's, yeah, it's the joy of stand-up, you know, it's the fact that you can, you know, it's not like, you know, if you're doing TV or film or whatever, you've got to do that thing of you come up with an idea, you've got to write it, the script's got to go off, it's got to go through all of these other departments, it's got to, and, you know, you've got to be approved by somebody and, oh, yeah, right, I get that thing commissioned. The beauty of stand-up is it pops into your head, comes out your mouth, it just happens, you know? And I think my shows tend to be, as you say there, you try and describe one of my shows to somebody the next day. The show I'm probably my next to, I might just be called You Had to Be There, because it is one of those things where you go, yeah, you kind of had to be there, really. But I love it, you know? So, Ross, yeah. I mean,
that part of it absolutely fascinates me, because like you said about comedians potentially doing something with a message or trying to get some form of deep-rooted opinion out there. Yeah, it's very obvious. I mean, I've never seen you live. I mean, incidentally, you are playing in Harrogate, which is very near me on the 8th of November, but I won't do it.
All right, I'll put you on the list right here.
I was just mentioning that in passing. But that sense of if people were to get clever about it and deconstruct it, because that interaction between yourself and an audience, first and foremost, you look at it and say that takes supreme confidence. It takes a lot of control of in what you're doing, but that ability, that confidence to be able to go, well, he's or they've said that, let's see where this goes. And you, and what I see from you is just a total, and obviously this would have taken years to get to, but a total ease in front of big groups of people where there is no act. The act is you. It's you and you chatting as yourself, isn't it? And being comfortable enough to do that.
But you're right. You don't sort of, you know, I started doing it when I was 15, and it's one of those things where, you know, when you first start out and you do 5 minutes, and you're in these like, and back then, like, you know, sort of the early 90s, it wasn't, you know, I think what I think sometimes people forget is like now, you know, you've got things like, you've got Live at the Apollo, you've got Netflix, you've got people, stand-up has become ubiquitous now. But even going back to the sort of late 90s, you would have the odd show on TV. You know, you'd have your Jasper Carrots and your Billy Connollys and people like that who would be on the telly. But it was still, it still wasn't, stand-up wasn't like, I mean, you had your VHS, your Chubby Brown at Christmas and all that. You know, and that's where it lived. It was on, you know, people weren't watching Netflix specials. They would buy a VHS. And usually, they used to call it the primary gifting period. DVDs and VHSs only ever came out in November to Christmas and then no other time of the year. So it's the sort of thing where back then you would do like gigs in pubs and people would be like, you'd still have people going, so are you, you're an alternative comic? Then you're one of them alternative comics. There's people who told jokes and then there was alternative. So it's one of those things where a lot of the early gigs, people didn't even know that there was supposed to be comedy on, you know? So this, I did a gig once and it was in a pub and the football was on and there's a big screen. It was an England match. And the guy said, right, after the match, we'll lift the screen up. And I went, sorry, what? You lift the screen up? Yeah. There was an alcove behind the screen. And he said, you stand there. So I was stood there for the penalties behind the screen. And England lose, the whole pub's like, boo, boo, like that. Like that. Everyone's like, duff, and there's arguments kicking off. And then the screen starts to slowly rise. All you could see was my feet. And the bloke on the mic, and he's like, ladies and gentlemen, now it's time for comedy. Nobody was there for comedy. And it was like, please welcome your host for this evening, Mr. Ross Noble. And it was only at my knees. So it was just, it was like, I was like a very shy contestant on Naked Attraction.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like Naked Attraction. Yeah.
It was slowly appearing. And then I was like, right, it's comedy time. People are just like, daft. So obviously, when you then get to the point where you build up your own following and then you have your, you know, you have your audience that come to see you. You're in a nice theatre. They're all facing the right way. You know, you've got your set, you've got your lights and everything. And people know what they've come to and they want to laugh. it's one of those things where that sort of you're halfway there, really.
Do you have to pinch yourself sometimes now if you think back to a young 15-year-old yourself when you go into these pubs or you're playing these clubs and, you know, like I said, after people aren't really interested, and now you're selling out arenas, people want to come and see you because it's you. I mean, that must be lovely. Did you think back then you'd make a living out of it? Did you have a dream you'd do as well as you have?
You know what? I always said that, like, my thing was I just wanted, initially it was that thing of like, I just want to make a living at it. I just want to get to the point where I didn't have a job, and that happened really quickly. And then my thing was, I thought if I could just be popular enough to play theatres, that's me happy. And to be honest, that when that happened, it was just, I always had that thing. To me, the pinnacle was always the idea of, and this is because I love all that old variety music hall and all that. To me, the pinnacle was like playing the London Palladium. And that was, and I'm on this tour, past few tours, now I'm doing like multiple nights at the London Palladium, and that's just, it's all, just playing there. You go, just playing there with other people would have been enough, But to sort of go, London Palladium, that's, once you get to that, that's it, isn't it? I mean, So
where then, Russ, with regards to the tour and that side of your life, and then suddenly you're in literally shark-infested waters on ITV, and it's something you can catch up as well on ITVX. I mean, so it seems, and again, when you talk about earth-moving equipment and operating heavy machinery, there's an element of risk attached to your life that you thoroughly enjoy.
I always say, it's like people always go, do you get nervous? And, are you scared? And I always say the same thing, like with the shark show, which if people haven't seen, can I just point out, yes, it's a real show. I know it sounds like it isn't. And I genuinely, when I got offered it, because you get offered these things and I turn them all down. And then this one came through and they were like, do you want to do a celebrity shark infested? Celebrity swim with sharks? And I genuinely thought that my manager was taking a piss. And I just went off. I thought she'd basically, like, she was going through stuff and going, oh, and then this, you interested in this, you interested in that. And because I always say, no, I go, no, I don't want to do that, I don't want to do that. Nah, that's not me. I thought that she'd gone, oh, I'll put this one in just to see if he realizes that I'm taking the. She went, celebrity swimming with sharks. I was like, piss off. She went, no, really. And then gave me the email. And I went, God, that is a thing. And then when I actually, like, had a meeting with I read the document and I thought, oh, this isn't like an I'm a celebrity. This isn't just taking a bunch of people off Love Island and chucking them in. Because I thought that's what it was. I honestly thought it would be like me and a bunch of people from Love Island in harnesses getting dipped into shark-infested water, maybe smeared in fish guts or something. Yeah. And when they said, oh, no, it's a genuine, it's going to be a genuine show about, showing people how amazing sharks are. And once they said it's, because that's what it is, basically. It's basically like if David Attenborough was making a show and he couldn't do a few of the episodes, so he got his head mate to do it, like, can you just jump in with these sharks and do it? That's what it is. But, yeah, people often, like, when we were doing that show, the producers would, they'd point the camera at you and they'd go, are you scared? And I would say, and it's a line I nicked from Mark Rylance in a film, in Bridge of Spies. He goes, are you scared? And I would say the same thing. I go, would it help? Because it's that thing of, you know what it's like, especially with motorbikes. People who don't ride bikes, they just go, oh, they're really dangerous and you'll kill yourself.
Isn't it? That's the first thing, yeah.
Yeah, they're really dangerous and you'll kill yourself. And you just sort of go, right, so you've put that at the top of the list of things. I can list 100 things that I think about more than these are dangerous and they're going to kill. the freedom, the excitement, the you know, the you know, the being out in nature. If you know, if you're riding a, you know, enduro bikes, the fact that you're in incredible scenery, the fact that, you know, there's just there's this big long list, and it's exactly the same as you know, when people go, oh, you know, you stand up comedy, that's, oh, you get nervous, and you can, and you get excitement. And I think it's like anything in life, and the shark was the same. You can kind of spend your whole life going, oh, I'm really nervous about this. Or you can go, well, why am I feeling like, why have I got this adrenaline? And that adrenaline, to me, I don't frame it as nerves. I frame it as excitement. Yeah. And that's the same, you know, and that's the same with, you know, if you're riding a bike, or like if you're racing motorbikes, it's one of those things where, you know, nerves on a stage. Like if I, you know, doing the, you know, enduro racing, and you're lining up, and some of those races, you know, there'd be like rows and rows of bikes, and you're looking up the top of the hill, and you think, right, we're all going towards that, and you feel this, you know, what you would, some people would deem to be nerves, and then you're off, and you're flying across, you know, you're flying around some woods or whatever, and instead of going, oh my God, I'm going really fast, and if I get this wrong, I'll go to the handlebars and I'll hit a tree, you're thinking, oh my God, I get to do this. This is, this is, I, you know, I, and that's like with anything. It's sort of like, weirdly, actually, sorry, I will let you speak in a moment. It's, weirdly, I was watching, I was watching a thing about running, and there was a, and the same thing of like, you know, when you're, you know, the guy that I was listening to was talking about the fact that, you know, getting to the point where you're absolutely gassed out and you've got nothing left in the tank, and rather than going, oh my God, I've reached the end, that thing of going, this is my opportunity. This is an opportunity to dig deep, and and not, oh my God, my body is absolutely gasping for breath. He was talking about the fact that his brain's going, I get to do this. I get to experience this.
Yeah. Those are the moments when you feel alive, you know, whether it's pain through running or adrenaline through taking a corner too fast, whatever it is, that's the feeling of alive. Can we, let's take it back, Ross, if we can, to when that feeling first started for you in terms of the love of bikes, because you've touched on it there. You've ridden all sorts of different types of bikes over different terrains. You love it. When did you first fall in love with riding bikes? Because most people we speak to, it'll be an uncle or a dad who got them into bikes. Was that the case for you?
No, quite the opposite, in fact. Both my dad, I say he had a motorbike accident. He did. He used to ride a little scooter, and he had ridden home to my nana and granddad, their house, and he rode in, and the garage door was open, and he had a little, it was just a little scooter thing, but he had a backpack on with a banjo in it, and he forgot the banjo was in the back, and he rode into the garage, the banjo caught on the door, the bike kept going, smashed into the wall, and he fell on his ass. And so he would go, oh, they're dangerous motorbikes. And I went, no, banjos are dangerous. You need to avoid banjos, you idiot. You know what I mean? Hillbillies, they're the ones you've got a problem with. So my dad was always very, my mum was very anti, you know, like all of this, you know, like, because like I said, naturally, I'm just looking for adventure all the time. She was always like, oh, that's dangerous, I don't want, you know, and it comes from a well-meaning place. But no, motorbikes, I remember when I was a kid, we went on holiday, and there was a beach, and it had like, they had these little kids quad bikes in the sand, and I pestered my mum and dad to have a go on them, and I remember going around this sandy track, and just loving it. Going, I really like the feeling of this. And I was like, I want to do this. I want to ride motorbikes, quad bikes and stuff. And they just went, well, they didn't have the money, but it was the thing of like, no. When I was a kid, I loved, like all kids my age, the Street Hawk tapes. And I really loved Kickstart as well. Oh, So when I was a kid, I used to, I had a Grifter, wanted a BMX, never got a BMX, but it was the sort of thing where I just remember where we lived, where I grew up, it was like a new town. It's one of the first places in Britain to have, back in the 60s, the 70s, it had cycle tracks that linked the whole town together. So we could go out on our bikes and just ride around the whole town, never have to cross the road. And I loved riding bush bikes. And that was, but I was desperate to ride motorbikes, but just not allowed. Now, I'd play Kickstart on the bikes and all that. And then it wasn't until I moved to London and I was earning money. And I thought, I'll get a proper motorbike. But because comedians, the insurance for comedians is, it's basically publicans, people who run pubs, comedians and stunt people are the most, the highest bracket for insurance. Late nights, booze and kids, you know, that sort of thing. And I looked at the insurance and the only thing I could really afford at the time, I got a Honda 50cc Honda pizza bike. And it was one that somebody had done the knowledge on. So it had a clipboard on the front. So I left the clipboard on, bought an A to Z. All the taxi drivers thought that I was doing the knowledge. So they'd let you out in traffic and they'd always wave you through. And I learned how to get around London on this 50cc. And I paid more in insurance than I did for the bike. Wow. So that was my first. And yeah, I used to do miles on it. I had a gig in Southend once and I went, well, the thing only did about 35 miles an hour, but it was, and it was that thing of, that was when so I moved to London and that's when I went, all right, this is, I can do this now. And then bit by bit, then as the insurance got cheaper and I started earning more money, then I started moving up. I got a 125 and then I got a band at 600 and then I was completely hooked. And then the bikes just started to get, bigger and bigger. And then I ended up at one point I was riding an original Hayabusa, the ones that weren't restricted, And it was one of those things where, again, the insurance on that was just insane. You know, somebody in their early 20s riding a Hayabusa, it's just like
living in London as well.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Quick bit of mid-show housekeeping, folks. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get podcasts from. So, Ross, that's the earlier days of your biking. What's, without giving us too much details and making us too envious, what's the current bike/bikes at the moment?
Well, you know what? It's actually, at the moment, it's, I've thinned it. I've got up to, I had 15 at one point. I was, that's when I went, well, I probably pushed it a bit here. At one point I had a bike that for everything. So it was like, I know it was ridiculous. So I had like a sports bike. I used to have a Gixxer 750. That was like my track bike. You know, I used to, I had it all, you know, it was all prepped for the track. So I had a track bike, I had several trials bikes, an enduro bike, an adventure bike. What else did I have? I had like a Street Fighter and a, ridiculous. It was just keeping up the, you know, just constantly keeping all the paperwork up to date was, you know.
Well, some of those secret bikes, because I know if I ever buy myself a new tour, I've got to hide away from the missus. I mean, 15's a lot of bikes to hide. I'm assuming your family are well on board with this. It's not a hobby for you, is it? It's a lifestyle. But yeah,
you know what? It was one of those things where I had a shed and she would look into the shed and I wasn't, I, to be honest, because she'd just go, I'd be sat there and she'd go, what are you looking at? I'd go, I'm going to buy this. And she'd go, all right, are you? And then she'd look in the shed and I used to rotate them as well. So bikes would come and go. And so it was, they all just, you know what? Where better to hide a book than in a library? That's what I always say. So you need a lot of, but no, at the moment I've got a KTM Super Adventure, which basically just does everything. And then I've got my dirt bike. So yeah, I haven't got a big collection at the moment.
Some in the UK, some in Australia, or is everything shipped over?
No, just everything's here. So, right. But yeah, I was having a little cheeky look online there. I might, yeah. I think if we move back to the UK, then I'll probably start building the collection up again. But yeah, nice. Yeah, because when we moved back here like 7 years ago. So I kind of started again. But to be honest, one of those things where nowadays the trials bikes are kind of, if I want to ride, I'd rather be out on the trials bike than anything else, really.
So what then? Within that shed with the bikes in, does the tank still exist?
No, I sold the tank as well. I sold my tank. And I also used to have a
tank.
Strictly speaking, it was a self-propelled artillery gun, because I know you get the real spotty kind of military vehicle enthusiast. But why tell everyone you have a tank? It's a self-propelled artillery gun. I go, that is true. And from where I used to live, if it was fully armed, I could have taken out Gatwick.
Tell us a story about when you very nearly took out your neighbour, if you could. I love that story with your neighbour in the tank.
Oh, that was... are you talking about the old man in the hedge? Are you talking about the... Or there was a guy...
You faced it towards your neighbour, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was a property developer bought the house next door. And he was basically... He was a proper chancer, you know, and he did this thing where at one point he sort of cut through the fence and he came into our garden and he was a bit of a dick to my wife and I wasn't happy about it. So I got my tank and I parked it facing his house. And he didn't even live there, but yeah. And I parked it just facing towards this place that he was trying to develop while him and his architect were down there. And I just parked the tank and I said to my missus, I went, I literally parked my tank on his lawn. And she just went, have you done that? Have you parked it? And I said, oh, do you think that's a bit passive aggressive? And she went, it's not passive aggressive. You've literally declared war on him. And so, yeah. But the tank. I used to have this big van as well, and it was like a splitter van. So I had half of it. The back half was a garage that I could put the dirt bikes in, and then the rest of it, I had like a bed and a little camping thing. So I could go and if I wanted to go and do a race, or if I wanted to go and ride in Wales or up north or whatever. I was fully self-contained.
Yeah.
So I didn't even have to load stuff up. It was like I had racks for my helmets and stuff. So I got rid of that as well. Yeah.
That one sounds, and there's nothing passive aggressive or aggressive about something that you can transport your gear around. I love that question. Do you think it was a bit passive aggressive? No, I think by definition, tanks are aggressive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Nothing passive about a tank. Margaret, I mean, you talk about that, and I presume there'd be an element of this property developer knowing potentially who he's living next door to. It's looking at the cost of getting out of a tank, but is that part of of what motorcycling is to you, Ross? Helmet on, no one knows who you are.
Well, what I was going to say was is that I think the way that my mates used to describe it is, do you remember how the papers used to describe lottery louts? You know, the people that like won the lottery and then they'd have the next thing you know, they'd build like a motocross track in their garden. That's what my mates used to describe me as. They go, would I really want to live next door to you? Just like, no, absolutely. Like, putting the helmet on and just kind of, but it's not necessarily about, wanting to be, I know some people talk about it, you know, it's that thing of like, put the helmet on, the anonymity. It's more just that thing of like, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be on your own, you know? And like, I find it very, I spend all my time with my family. Like, it's, you know, I love them to bits. But there's something about, to me, like riding motorbikes, there's something about putting a helmet on, kind of, you've got to, like, it's one of the few things that, you know, you kind of have to really concentrate, kind of keeps you present, you know? And it's, you're sort of,
yes,
you know, that feeling of like if you're just sitting in a chair, or you know, some people go, oh, I love to just sit and look at the view. And that's no good for me because I might be looking at the view, but my head's somewhere else. Like, I get lost in this sort of, like, I get lost in the noise. Whereas on a bike, it's one of those things where the noise is still happening, but the noise is sort of pushed aside because you're actively, again, it's going back to that stand-up thing, right? Like, you're acting all the time. You know, as if, you know, you're on the motorway, you go past a truck and you get the wobble, or you're on a country lane and you come around the corner and there's a crack in the tarmac and, you know, oh, that looks, there's some leaves there, that's a bit slippy. And your brain's constantly making all of these decisions. And you can still think your thoughts, but I think that often if I go for a ride and I've got stuff, I think this is just the, you know, again, when people go, oh, they're dangerous and they'll kill you, you also go, motorbikes are brilliant for working out just working out your shit, you know, because you get to the end of the ride and you might not think that you've thought about whatever's going on in your life. But you have, because you're thinking about it, but you've been so focused on what reacting to stuff, you're still thinking those things, but it's kind of a subliminal. And now I'd like you to read this leaflet about Jesus.
I think bikes have got a way to not only just humble you, haven't they? But like you said, you're so concentrating on the here and now. And like for me, for my mental health, if I'm not feeling great, I'll go for a run or go out on a bike. Or you're something magical about putting that helmet on and not even planning an A to B route, just going for a ride because you want to ride. And you know, any you've got going on in your head, like it will clear itself out. And for people who don't ride bikes, they don't understand that. But it's just magical. You know, the senses, like you describe it with so much passion, you know, going out on a ride, it's unrivaled. It's amazing.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I think there's a lot of parallels. So like I'm really into trail running. And so I did like probably the best thing I ever did, like my greatest achievement, if you like, in terms of biking, was I spent 6 months, there's this amazing race, this 24-hour race, down in Wales, like an enduro loop, difficult terrain. And I spent 6 months where I just trained for that. I did it every year for about 5 or 6 years. And then I finally won it. Like, I just complete focus. That's all I was thinking. Took loads of time off. And like the club, man, I didn't win the pros or anything. But and then, so I did that. And And then, so I got into trail running, and I went and did, so I went and did a 24-hour run, you know, like a 24-hour trail run. And there's a real similarity between, because I thought, well, hang on, if I can do this on a bike, because weirdly, riding an enduro bike for 24 hours is a lot harder than running for 24 hours. Mm. I know that seems insane,
but there's
a very similar. So anyway, so I went and did like a 24-hour ultra last year, and there's a very similar thing between the running and the biking. There's a very similar. We need to sit down at some point and compare the two, because there's a very similar. And again, it's one of those things where some people get it from the, you know, find a nice windy road, and that does it for some people. And then for me, it's one of those things where, especially with a trials bike, you can have an area that's probably, you know, no bigger than, you know, a couple of hundred meters, you know, with a bit of a hill and a couple of steps or whatever, and you set out a course. I can ride, if I have a bit of a trials course set out, I can literally ride for 5-6 hours, and literally my wife will, yeah. And like, people go, oh, you need to go off, you need to have loads of, not at all, it's a small area, have the obstacles that you have to get through, and you just keep riding it over and over again. And it becomes like a sort of, my wife can come out and go, you've been riding for 5 hours now. You know, often the petrol will run out before I do, you know.
There's a synergy between, you know, you're out there for a long period of time. It's pretty physically demanding, but also it's really mentally demanding as well. And people think exactly. When you're just running, you can just switch off, but you're not. You're having to concentrate on your foot placement. And it's exactly the same, I imagine, as enduro riding. I've done some enduro days, but only for a couple of hours at a time. And I come off dripping in sweat, and it is a hard work. It really is.
Well, that's the thing. People, you know, people sort of think, you're on it, but it's not like a, oh, it's not like a push bike where you're pedaling all the time. But it's one of those things where you're standing up and moving around. And I think that more and more now, like you say, you know, mentioning the mental health thing, I think more and more now people are just realizing that, you know, there's an idea that motorbikes are, you know, and there are, you know, some people where it's kind of, it's some sort of like macho, tough guy thing. But actually, in terms of like from a mental health point of view, you know, you can read 100 self-help books. You could pay, I would say it's cheaper to buy a motorbike than it is to go and visit a therapist on a, you know, on a regular basis. And I think that's what, you know, people who aren't into bikes probably just don't realize just how, oh, that sound like, am I sounding like the Dalai Lama?
No, it's true. You're not having to convert us, mate. We've been preached to, and we love it. There's something magical about biking, whatever form of two wheels it is. And if you don't get it, you don't get it. But I guarantee, if you go on the back of a bike, even as a pillion, you'd get it. It's like nothing else.
Yeah. So I've, you know, you, we should go and do, we should go and do an, when I'm back in the UK, we should go and do an, like an enduro. I think you'd, I'd be fascinated. I would be fascinated to see, you know, because it's one of those things where I'd be fascinated to see how you respond, you know, because that sort of, you don't have to try and win it. But there's an interesting thing, like, you know, you go to a local event, probably like a local enduro might be 3 hours, 4 hours, and you're on a loop. So it's one of those things where, I mean, look, when I did the, when I did some of the, you know, some of the races that I've done where there's been pros, you know, in the race as well, that's an incredible thing, because there's not many sports where you can be competing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like turning up to the golf with your own clubs and going, can I have a go? You know,
Yeah, when you come back, we'll do it. I've done a couple of afternoons doing it before, enduro biking and green laning, and I love it, but I find it hard. Like, and I've ended up in A&E a couple of times as well, where I've fallen off and broke the wrist. You know, but it's a proper sport, and I think, like you said earlier, people think, oh, because it's got an engine, you're not doing all the hard work. Yeah, you are.
Yeah,
it's very hard. Yeah.
And can I ask, have you tried trials riding?
No, not but like you, I loved Kickstart and Junior Kickstart when I was growing up. I used to watch it, but you know, I've never had a proper go on it. So when you're back,
yeah, get it in the diary. Look, I can't even begin to like so I got to the point where I went to the Scottish 60 and officially, like Dougie Lampkin, who is like
God.
Like off the like literally, it's one of those things where, you know, when you see these documentaries about like you know, like Formula One drivers and stuff, and they talk about the level of skill and their quick reactions and their ability trials riders, it's like you know, you look at like Dougie Lampkin is like off the chart. And it's one of those things where, you know, Dougie described me in his book, I might say, I think he described me as a good club rider, right? Now, that to me is possibly the greatest compliment that I've ever had, right? Now, I went to the Scottish 60. Nobody thought that I would be able to finish it, right? Now, in the big scheme of things, I'm shit, right? The Scottish 60, right, is the most technical motorcycle event in the world, right? Now, I finished it, right? I was second to last. I mean, there was about, you know, so many of the field don't even finish, but I finished it, got me little thing, little pewter thing there. But to be described as, like, a decent club rider is, like, my level of skill, they are so, you know, people look at me and go, oh, he's pretty handy, did the Scottish 60. The level of skill that is going on in the top flight is beyond, like, it, like, have a go. Like, I would encourage anyone to just have a go at trials. Like, even just, like, you know, set out a couple of, you know, put a couple of cones out and just do some figure of eights, full lock turns, you know, really slowly, going less than walking speed, not going up obstacles and doing all that sort of, which is great, by the way, it's great fun going up all that sort of stuff, but just have a go on a trials bike and it will literally, like I say, I've been doing it a while now, and it's one of those things where it's the difference between somebody who can pick up a guitar and play a few tunes, you know what I mean? Like playing a pub band and Hendrix. That's the, you know, that's the difference, you know. But again, it's yeah, trials is in terms of just mentally, like, you know, you've got to decide on you've got to pick your line, you know, certain sections, the tires got to be exactly on the grippy part of the rock, and it has to, and then you throttle, and you know, the clutch and the throttle and everything balancing. And honestly, even doing something that just looks like, you know, riding around a couple of rocks on a hill, you can spend 10 hours just doing that. So yeah, I heartily recommend it.
I mean, the fact that, I mean, a compliment from Dougie Lampkin along those lines would rank amongst the proudest moments, I think, of anyone's life. But this, within the podcast, when we get to this stage, where we ask you the final question, and I've got it, and it's about an idyllic ride. But given the fact that you can spend 5 hours in the back garden,
you're going to need a big tank. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So the final question is, it's your fantasy ride. It's where you'd be going, what you'd be riding, who you'd be riding with potentially, and whether you'd have a soundtrack on. But again, like I said, given how you've described your just utter joy and innocence and childlike enthusiasm for just a full tank, a trials bike and some rocks. I mean, this could be anything, mate, couldn't it? The answer to this could be anything.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I, When I lived in Kent, we used to one of my favorite places to ride. I love riding in the desert. That's to me is I love it. So going down to Morocco, yeah. I would say like down to Erg Chebbi, you know, where all the have you been down there to the
yes,
to the big
yeah.
the big dunes? And did you get out into the desert there?
I managed to get to the tip of the Sahara. So I was on a GS, an adventure.
Oh yeah,
Nearly fell off when I went. That looks like a camel. Oh, it is a camel. Oh, it's by the side of the road. And then I had to kind of just put my brakes and calm down. So I got to the edge of the Sahara. Didn't go any further. So I took an adventure bike all the way down to the Sahara, Ross. Didn't get it on the sand because I was terrified.
Well, you know, they're quite heavy GSs, aren't they? Yeah. But we used to do a thing. As me and my mate, we got so fed up of people. Got so fed up of people going, oh, them big adventure bikes, they're really heavy, them adventure bikes. Oh, they're too heavy. You can't really take them off-road. So what we used to do down at my place, we would set up trial sections for the adventure bikes, and we'd take them out in the woods and razz them around. I reckon, so down there, so there's like the Cathedral Dune, and like a couple of hundred feet high, and then on a... like a probably a two-stroke, 300 two-stroke enduro bike, that would probably be. And then you can ride through the dunes and you can sort of, you can drop into, there'll be these like big sand bowls and you can drop into those. And then you get in the bottom and you can't just ride up the edge of them. So you have to ride them like a wall of death. So you're sort of leaning over and you go around and then you pop out at the top, you know? And then when you're cutting through the desert, because you got to keep the throttle on, if you chop the throttle, if you just try and slow down, the front wheel digs in, you go over the handlebars. So you're in this deep sand, this soft sand, and you just got the bike's just cutting through it like butter. And it's just, nobody's, you know, you might get the odd camel track or whatever, but yeah, that would probably be, I'd probably say that. Or I did the Romaniacs, the Red Bull Romaniacs. That was in the Carpathian Mountains, and that was an incredible place to ride. I mean, obviously, because it's Romaniacs, it's insane. I'd quite like to go back there and ride it where you're not going, oh my God, just bikes flying over your head and stuff. But yeah, I reckon probably Morocco on an enduro bike, or alternatively up in Yorkshire, because where all the Yorkshire Trials lads are. Up there, there's some streams and again the Scottish 60. I mean, to me, a nice rocky kind of stream. Maybe a van with a bit of food, and then a bunch of mates together. I would say a Dougie Lampkin, but the fact that like it's one of those things where. He's such a hero. But at the same time, it's one of those things where it's a bit like, it's like any of those top flight lads. Again, it's like deciding to have a game of golf and the greatest golfer in the world turns up and is just chatting away, not with one hand, hitting holes. So it's kind of like, it's kind of tricky, you know. Yeah. So that to me, some nice woods. Maybe it's a quarry and a trials bike. That would do me.
I love the fact you've chosen mainly properly off-road stuff, which is where your heart is at, because you know a lot of people say Route 66 on a Harley or something, which is pretty predictable. But I like the fact you've gone off-piste a little bit. Lovely,
literally.
Yeah,
and literally. No, roads are good. I like roads. I did a 26,000 kilometer road trip around Australia. Wow. Which I did that on one of the early GSs, the 1150. And that was incredible because, again, you know, just out there, you're riding on the tarmac, but you're riding through the desert. Did a full loop, rode across South Africa as well, went up through South Africa, Namibia, and all the rest of it. And again, scenery's great, but yeah, give me a quarry and a trials bike, and I'll be more than happy. Thanks.
I'll tell you what, Prutz, out of all the guests we've had, you've got to say Ross has definitely been there, done it, got the t-shirt. In terms of just some of the stuff you've mentioned there, people can only dream of doing one of those adventures. You've had a good biking life, my friend.
It's funny that you mentioned t-shirts, because all I'm saying is, give me a quarry. Yeah. I like roads. You know what I mean? Just Ross Noble merchandise. Just one line.
give me a quarry. Give me a quarry and the smell of two-stroke. oh no! Look, it's one of those things where you know I don't, as you can tell, I don't really do anything in half measures. You know, so it's one of those things where, yeah, once I got a taste for it, I just went nuts for it and just went, I want to do all of this, you know. So why wouldn't you, you know?
Yeah. Well, Ross, it's been an absolute pleasure. You mentioned Dougie Lampkin a couple of times. We're trying to get him on the pod. So if you want to mention that in dispatches next time you're texting him, that'd be great. Don't invite him for a race. Just say get on this. He'd love it.
You know, the trouble is it because he's literally. Has he not been available? Because when he practices, he literally, there's a place that he goes to, and it's mad, it's unbelievable, right? So when he's practicing, there's this place, and it's a river. I say a river. It starts off with like little pebbles, and then the rocks become the size of house bricks, and then they get bigger, and then they're like waist high, right up until they're like, and there's water running down, and then they get higher and higher until you get right up to the very top, and it curves around, and then there's like a big waterfall at the top, and it's like a massive great big step, and he literally goes there and he just rides round and round and round until he's, you know, and he does it and he cleans it, he's just cleaning it the whole time, just straight up all the time. So the chances are, I mean, I'm sure he'd come on here, but he's probably in a field somewhere,
probably,
you know, and he'd probably have to have like somebody have to walk out with a phone. And,
satellite phone.
So have you got close to getting him on?
It's a work in progress, I think our dear producer would tell us, but don't worry. We're a passive aggressive bunch on this podcast.
We'll borrow your tank and we'll aim at him.
I wish I had the tank so that you could get him there. I mean, like, yeah, no, you've got to get him on. He's a breed apart. I mean, he'll come on here and he'll tell you how I am. Like, he'd begrudgingly, I'm sure, put it in his book. He's like, he's become all right, but he'll go on. No, that's all wrong. That's all wrong. Absolute shit. You've got to get him on. He's very much he's a different beast. But I look forward to hearing it.
Yeah. Well, Ross, I mean, you've been absolutely wonderful, mate. Sadly, that's about it for this week's Full Chat powered by Bikeshaw. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikeshaw can tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter, or moped insurance and much, much more. Maybe even so if you've got 15 bikes, like Ross Noble once said. Anyway, moving on.
Or maybe even a tank. Ross, thank you so much to our wonderful guest. You've been absolutely superb. Of course, don't forget, you can see Ross on ITVX, the shark-infested waters. That is on right at the moment. And look forward to his tour, rossnoble.com. You can have a look at all the tickets, all the dates, and you won't be disappointed. Go and see him. You walk away thinking, what the... Yeah, was that about? Well, it's a good night out. Ross, you've been amazing. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. All of the Winchester tickets and Harrogate ones, there are no more comps available.
All the comps are gone. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so you never miss an episode. Or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
As ever, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining us. Until next time, see you later.